Welcome to Vashon 250. As America observes its 250th birthday, Voice of Vashon and the Vashon Heritage Museum have partnered to create our own recognition of this important milestone. We are looking back at what has happened in America since its beginning and examining how, over time, it has influenced our life on Vashon Island. In this second quarter of 2026, we continue to look at several of the famous high points that ultimately led to the Revolutionary War. I'm John Flora, and I'm joined by my colleague, resident historian, Bruce Holman. Welcome back to Vashon 250 and Episode 24, Thomas Paine's The American Crisis Pamphlets from December of 1776. In the next 30 minutes, we will discuss The American Crisis, or simply The Crisis. It's a pamphlet series written by 18th century Enlightenment philosopher and author Thomas Paine. Originally published from 1776 to 1783 during the American Revolution, 13 numbered pamphlets were published during those years, with three additional pamphlets released between 1777 and 83. The first of the pamphlets was published in the Pennsylvania Journal on December 19, 1776. Paine signed the pamphlets with the pseudonym Common Sense. These pamphlets were contemporaneous with early parts of the American Revolution when colonists needed inspiring works. Remember, Marconi hadn't invented the radio yet, Philo Farnsworth hadn't created TV, and there was no social media. There wasn't even Voice of Vashon. The American Crisis series was used to recharge the revolutionary cause. Paine, like many politicians and scholars, knew that the colonists were not going to support the American Revolutionary War without proper reason to do so. Written in a language that the common person could understand, they represented Paine's liberal philosophy. Paine also used references to God, saying that a war against Great Britain would be a war with the support of God. Paine's writings bolstered the morale of the American colonists, appealed to the British people's consideration of the war, clarified the issues at stake in the war, and denounced the advocates of a negotiated peace. The first volume begins, "These are the times that try men's souls." And to help us walk through this, we want to welcome back our good friend Nancy Bristow, a professor emeritus of American history from the University of Puget Sound in Tacoma. She's also the author of American Pandemic, The Lost Worlds of the 1980 Influenza Epidemic. Someday maybe we'll get to talk about that. Nancy, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Want to talk to us about the American crisis?
Sure I do, along with my colleague Bruce Holman right here. I know that you've already discussed at some length the first Common Sense pamphlet, which you did in episode 20 on June 23rd.
Correct.
So there were 12 other pamphlets for us to talk about, and those will be the focus of our work today. As John already suggested, one of the really key themes in these pamphlets will be the ways in which this is a war that would be sanctified by God. And again, this resonates so completely with what we come to think about later with, for instance, Manifest Destiny and the idea that that westward expansion was a God-given expectation and right. Here we have that being implanted in American culture, even as we are just beginning a war to become a country. Very much he suggests that, in fact, the British are claiming a kind of power that should only be reserved to God. And he compares what's happening to the Americans as if we were engaged in being enslaved. He said, quote, "If being bound in that manner is not slavery, then there is not such a thing as slavery on earth," end quote. So he's very clear that this is a God-given right to fight this war, and that in fact the colonists should imagine themselves as enduring a situation or a circumstance that could only be compared directly to slavery.
And a lot of what Paine is doing is essentially helping define what it means to be an American. You know, so it's that sense of here we have been British colonists for, you know, a number of years, and most people think of themselves as loyal British citizens. And so they're not really revolting against British citizenship. They're revolting against the Crown's imposition of what they see as illegal constraints on their rights as British citizens. And so it's interesting to put that in the context of what Paine's trying to write about. And he underlies everything he's writing with sort of two appeals, I see. One is that appeal to God and this appeal to sort of a religious, you know, sort of base, if you will. But also he's making an appeal to the rational mind of what it means to be a citizen, a British citizen. And then if that's being abused, you know, then become independent and define what you mean as an American citizen. So you've got these two sort of parallel but conflicting sort of definitions and sort of arguments going on in all of Paine's work.
And it's so interesting, right, because that is something that we see not just in Paine's work, but something that we've already talked about, the ways in which the appeal to both the divine and to sort of Enlightenment ideas are going to be so bound together in this revolutionary generation. And so he'll go on, right, to talk about this as very much a war against tyranny, right? And so this idea of what does it mean to be a citizen, to be a British citizen was supposed to mean you had certain rights and that you were free of a sort of tyrannical government. Mm-hmm. And the Americans at this point, though they're not describing themselves as Americans particularly, but these British citizens who are imagining a potential break are at this point really seeing that to fulfill their rights to what they have been given as British citizens is going to require them to respond in opposition to tyranny, right, that they're really going to have to stand up, even though this will be a terribly difficult battle. And he uses that, in a sense, as encouragement, because remember, this is a moment that these are times that try men's souls. This is a low point, a very low point, even as some people are wanting to push into a real war, a war that will be a war for independence, right? We already are there, and yet people are questioning that decision at this point. And so he makes the case that the fact that the battle is hard means it's the right battle, that it's a battle worth the trouble, that those are the ones that you really have to go after. He says, the harder the conflict, the more glorious the triumph. What we obtain too cheap, he goes on to say, we esteem too lightly. This is rather a glorious cause, as it will be eventually called.
Yeah, and that's where there's this dual appeal to the sacred and to God, but also an appeal to the natural rights of a citizen. You know, and he's echoing the Declaration of Independence, in effect. You know, and sort of this whole idea that you know we have a natural right to our freedom. You know, and to the words of the Declaration of Independence, at least the opening part of the Declaration of Independence. And then what he's able to do, and I think he's able to articulate it in a very common vernacular so that, you know, when it's read in a pub, you know, the guys who are not very well educated get what he's talking about. And it really gets into all of those sort of elements that are identified in the second part of the Declaration of Independence as the grievances. You know, what the king has done, what the crown has done. You know, they're taxing us. They're not, you know, they're imposing new judges on us. They're not allowing us the right to make our own decisions. All of those kind of things come from that appeal to reason within this context of this God-given right. And so it's a very fascinating way to understand how America emerges with these two sort of almost parallel arguments, one a sacred religious argument, one a secular sort of rational argument, and the two are not always in alignment, and it has played that way all the way through American history.
So if we take that forward over the last 250 years, Bruce, can you talk about some of the times in our in the subsequent history where his American crises maybe is reflected through more recent events?
Oh yeah, I think, you know, all through American history, you have pamphleteers. You know, today it's social media, but essentially it's all the same thing of trying to articulate, you know, positions on specific issues. And whether it's westward expansion, whether it's slavery, whether it's workers' rights, whether it's the building of railroads, I mean, we have been flooded in our history with pamphlets that are arguing, you know, us to go one way or another. And the real strong arguments essentially build on these two parallel arguments of sacred and profane, if you will, or the religious sort of God-given sort of direction and the natural rights sort of social sort of side of it. And the great example of that to me is, and I've talked about this before, is the Gettysburg Address. I mean, Abraham Lincoln in the Gettysburg Address, and it's 4 minutes long.
We all memorized it in fourth grade.
Yeah. But it's really a very powerful restatement in terms of the Civil War, in terms of the struggle over slavery, over the tremendous and horrific sort of warfare that's been going on, the death that sort of has dominated the Civil War period, and what Abraham Lincoln's trying to say, I think, at the end, is that this is all worth it because we've created something new, and that goes back to the Declaration of Independence. I mean, it's a new concept, it's a new way of being in the world, and it, to me, it sparks, you know, 200 years of revolutions around the world. It sparks the end of colonialism, or at least the collapse of colonialism, and we're still seeing it today in some of the last sort of remnants of that colonial fight.
So if we sort of look at Thomas Paine, who's the Thomas Paine of today? I'll throw that out to both of you. Or is there one?
It's such an interesting question for me, right. John. And here's the reason I think both Bruce and I paused is the thought I was having when Bruce was speaking just now was, even as this is about sort of forming an idea of what it means to be an American, it's a hotly contested concept. So everyone will employ the idea that they are the, you know, the ones that are standing up for those values and ideals pronounced in the Declaration and repeated and expanded on and made legible for so many people by Thomas Paine. That's a tradition to which people across the political spectrum, across political debates, across social and cultural debates in this country have disagreed.
Right.
And so to say, who is the Thomas Paine? A lot of people want to lay claim to that.
Yeah.
Yeah, that would be true.
Yeah, and I would argue that there are two prominent political figures who today sort of fill that role that Nancy just discussed. One is Barack Obama, and the other is Donald Trump. And they're appealing to very, very different versions of what it means to be an American and what America is all about. And yet they have almost fanatical bases, you know, who listen to them and who they appeal to and who really believe that they are speaking the language of truth. And it's hard to recognize that in America today. But you have two diametrically opposed versions of what America is. And Obama and Trump are major spokespersons for that.
So did you have other thoughts on the historical events? I think I may have cut you off at one point.
Oh, no, not at all. I love the question that you asked because you got me thinking about a range of things that hadn't entered sort of my thinking yet. But I think one of the things that's really interesting is to pinpoint some of the particular pamphlets that Paine put out and the issues that they raise and the ways that those also have parallels. So, for instance, in his issue number 2, he really talked about the desire for peace with England, that the people, you know, of what becomes the United States weren't anxious for a war. They weren't anxious for separation, but they really felt compelled toward it because independence was itself a natural right. And so there was no route forward to pursue that right that was theirs as British citizens. The only route they had was to go to war and to declare an independence. And in some ways that for me resonated, this idea of independence as a natural right. For me, the thing that comes immediately to mind is the fight against enslavement in the 19th century. And again, an obvious case, but an interesting one, because when you begin to think about how did that war come about, and there are lots of steps to it, but a really important one is the proliferation of writings about enslavement and what it really was. So I think immediately of somebody like Frederick Douglass, who made a career of fighting against enslavement, himself an escaped free man now, wrote a beautiful narrative, which he republished in different versions over the course of decades, but put his first book out in 1845, but also was on the lecture circuit, right, trying to share this idea. Harriet Jacobs will write a similarly remarkable memoir, and there are literally hundreds of these, some of which are unpublished, but which were written, people making the case, having served in the role of an enslaved person, who say, wait, no, this is against my human rights, and I'm going to declare that both by escaping and then by making the case publicly, both in written and oral forms, not unlike what we see back in, you know, the 1770s. Yeah. And again, I must, though it's not a book I enjoy, it was an important book in its time, Harriet Beecher Stowe's Uncle Tom's Cabin, filled with derogatory stereotyping of Black Americans. That said, it appealed for that reason to a wide white readership and had a profound impact on what would lead to ultimately the Civil War just a little less than a decade later. She published it in 1852.
And those same sort of processes you see with the suffrage movement and in the 1960s and after in the women's rights movement, you see it with the anti sort of segregation movement in the late 19th century, the opposition to Plessy versus Ferguson, the formation of the NAACP, and then the Brown versus Board of Education, the emergence of the modern civil rights, the second American Civil War, if you will. Throughout American history, that sort of Thomas Paine's rhetoric and his style and his approach of appealing to both natural rights and reason and God-given rights and sort of the sacred, you see just echoed throughout American history. It becomes a powerful sub-theme, I think, in all of American rhetoric.
So, and what I just have to chime in, what's remarkable, given my point earlier about how this is contested, think of the modern civil rights movement, and I think immediately of the Southern Manifesto, which is a declaration in opposition, not to Plessy versus Ferguson, but to the Brown decision, and they will appeal to the same rhetoric to make the opposite case, right? Because they're opposing desegregation, they're opposing civil rights. So, sorry, John, go ahead.
That's quite all right. So let's jump to the current day. Mm-hmm. As we always say, we live in contested times right now. What are some of the most significant resistance echoes of the American crisis in the country in the past decade?
Well, to me,
you touched on it with Obama and Trump.
Well, yeah, I mean that's sort of the great struggle of our times, and I think, you know, Thomas Paine's opening statement, you know, in Common Sense, the very first of these sort of pamphlets of the American crisis, he says, you know, these are the times that try men's souls. I mean, I don't know that there's a better statement of what's going on in the United States in the past decade than that. You know, we are in revolutionary times. I mean, people aren't shooting each other yet, it's certainly happening with ICE agents rounding people up, and it's, you know, it's getting to the point where armed conflict is not unthinkable in my mind. But at the same time, we live in an American crisis right now. And not to say that it's unique to America. Nancy, you may want to jump in here, but I mean, we've gone through numerous times where the union has been on the verge of sundering over a whole lot of different kinds of issues. And of course, the Civil War itself, we actually did sunder and fought each other, you know, with armies. But, you know, there have been other cases throughout American history where the armies may not have been official, but they were, you know, sponsored by coal companies or sponsored by ranchers or sponsored by labor unions or whatever. You know, it's sort of like, you know, we've had a contentious American history, and to try and overlook that and say, oh yeah, you know, we've had this sort of movement toward progress in American history is to ignore the realities of this sort of two strains, going back to Thomas Paine, of both sides appealing to the rational and to the sacred.
And there's one other piece of this that I think, Bruce, you would likely agree with me on. Another sort of charge that Paine makes against the British is deception, that they have been hiding the realities of what is happening. And again, that's one piece of this that feels really important, both to longer history in the United States, but also to recent history right here. You can't help but think about, you know, this declaration that, you know, we've just won a war with Iran, which is just very difficult. First, because they said it wasn't a war. Now it is a war. But also because this war has been extraordinarily costly. Fewer lives for Americans than many of our conflicts. But in Iran, that's not the, you know, again, we've lost many lives of innocent Iranians. We have spent billions of dollars on a war that Congress did not approve. And we've been told again and again that this is a victory of some sort. And yet the evidence for that remains means difficult to find. It appears that we're actually in a worse situation. So there's been a lot of just misrepresentation of what that war was about. Another example, what it is that ICE was doing. The reality is that, you know, this has become a very violent situation in the country. 52 people have died in ICE detention centers since President Trump took office, and that's four times the rate under the Biden administration. And this is coming from a well-researched study by Human Rights Watch. But this isn't information that the federal government is sharing with us. This is information we get because private researchers are collecting the information and doing the data and releasing it for us. So again, and you can trace this sort of, I want to say this sense that we can't trust the government any longer. That's not new here. Obviously, we can trace that back to the Vietnam War and to not only the Nixon administration, but the line that went on around the Vietnam War with Johnson, Kennedy, and Eisenhower as well. So this idea that Paine put forward that that you have the right to resist a deceptive government sort of helps to set up some of those struggles that I think we're seeing now with multiple sides within the country laying claim to what is true,
sure,
what is deceptive, where does the government fit into this, where should the government fit into my own life.
Right. Yep. Yeah, and I think you're right in terms of, you know, the deceptions of the Vietnam War and the release of the Pentagon Papers sort of brought that out. And the question is, will we see a similar release of the Iran papers or the ICE papers or the, you know, ballroom papers or the Epstein files, or, you know, I mean, it just goes on and on and on. And then the second part of it is the Watergate inquiry. You know, it's sort of that, you know, that deception and that cover up that went on. And we see it right now in Washington, D.C. in spades, if you will. And will that continue to be exposed and continue to develop into a Watergate-like kind of investigation and follow-up that leads to serious consequences for the perpetrators? You know, and that's just one time period of the 1960s and 70s. I mean, that has gone on throughout American history. And so, bam, we're right in the middle of it. And it's not anything new, but the intensity of it right now is more than any of us have experienced.
Well, and thinking back to Watergate, there was also leadership in the Congress that wanted to take that on. And if I have a frustration, it's like, where's that leadership today? And who is it? And they tend to be really polar opposites.
Right.
And does anybody come together anymore?
And that goes back to Bruce's earlier point that this is an unusual moment. There are many times that try our souls as Americans over the decades and centuries, but this is a moment at which we're really in such deep disagreement about what's the matter. So that the idea that you would have a release of something that we could all look at and say, ah, so what we need to do is, the way we felt during Watergate, right? I can remember neighbors who were, you know, Republicans to their bones and their disappointment over what they saw as the misbehavior of a president who was not living up to the responsibilities of the office. Again, it's harder to find people across the political spectrum who can find a place to agree on what those responsibilities look like or even what is true.
You know, and for me, I think the key is the Epstein files. It's the one thing that people across political spectrum find horrifying. And whether or not that will come out and how that will come out, and when it does come out, you know, you will see a unified response across the political spectrum. All the other things that are going on, whether it be the reflecting pool or the ballroom or the Trump arc or putting his visage on Mount Rushmore, there's all kinds of things, and even the war in Iran and the withdrawal from Afghanistan and what's going on in Gaza. I mean, those are politicized, and people along the spectrum, I don't think, are ever going to agree on those. One thing that people can agree on is the horrific sort of experiences of young women in the Epstein files. Mm-hmm. Whether that will happen or not is the question. But if it does, I think that's the unifying force that will pull the country together in a way that nothing else will.
So in our remaining minutes, let's bring this home to our little rock here on the center of, in the center of Puget Sound. What events do we have here, I guess from the 50s forward, that would emulate some of what we're talking about here?
Well, I think, the idea of what does it mean to be an island, or what makes Vashon Island distinct. One of the great sort of events was the fight over the glacier mine. Mm-hmm. And that sort of whole process. I mean, that was over a 10-year fight. It began in 1998 when Glacier announced its expansion. And by 2008, it looked like it was lost. It looked like they were gonna take over. And then in a matter of a couple years, there's a stay by Judge Martinez. There's a sort of Governor Gregoire announces a cleanup of Puget Sound. There's a huge protest, what I call the Orca protest, at the glacier site. In 2009, and this is one of those interesting things to me, there's a boat trip in which citizens the Cascade Land Conservancy organize a boat trip to bring the CEO of Cal Portland, who owned the mine, the CEO of Taiyo, which was a Japanese company that owned Cal Portland, along with a phone call to Bill Ruckelshaus, a Northwesterner who had been director of the EPA. And on that boat trip and in that conversation, essentially, they came together. Dan Chasen, one of my good friends, and a really fine Vashon historian, said unexpectedly peace broke out. Sort of like all this contention, and on that boat trip, they were able to understand, to be able to put together the money from the Sarco settlement, the money that the state had aside, money from King County, and bam, within a year, the site was sold, and it became, what it is now, the Moriah Natural Area. So that's a very powerful example of how that struggle, like the Revolutionary War, can take place on Vashon Island. There's certainly no armed conflict, but there's certainly strong feelings, and it comes together.
Yeah, well, that's good. And on that note, we bring this episode to a close. We hope you've enjoyed this, and Nancy, thanks for joining us again. And be with us next time when constitutional scholar Craig Bellis joins Vashon 250 to discuss the emergence of the Vermont Republic and its constitution that prohibited slavery. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you next time.
Bruce and I invite you to join us again each week through the end of 2026 for interesting stories about our collective American and Vashon Island history. If you have a question, comment, or suggestions of a topic we might want to cover, please drop an email to Vashon250. At voiceofvashon.org. Vashon 250 is a production of Voice of Vashon and the Vashon Heritage Museum. Our producer is Truman O'Brien. Vashon 250 is sponsored by NACM Business Credit Services, a 126-year-old association focused on credit education and professional financial services for business credit departments across the nation. For more information, go to nacmbcs.org. We appreciate their support. Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you next time.